I'm the founder of WDS. We have a great team, but all of us are the first to recognize that, you know, what makes it a great community is at least 50% composed of the community. It's like the people that come, they are bringing something that creates whatever that magic is that, that people feel. And so I always want to acknowledge that first. I guess second, though, I would say that I also believe in a curated experience. I also believe in an agenda and putting forward a message. I think people should do this more in their art or their work.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Hey, it's Srini. Before we get to today's episode, I was wondering if I could ask you for a quick favor. If you'd be interested in watching The Unmistakable Creative as a TV show on Netflix, send us a tweet at unmistakablecr or email me at srini@unmistakablemedia.com if you know anybody who might be able to help us make this happen. Chris, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you back here. It's a bit weird to have to introduce you because it's very unlikely that nobody in our audience has actually heard of you. But on the off chance that they don't know about your work, can you give us sort of the quick Reader's Digest version of who you are and your work and how you have arrived at all these crazy things that you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure there's lots of people who haven't heard of my stuff. So I'm a writer, traveler, entrepreneur. That's kind of the three-word elevator pitch. I've been publishing a blog for about 8 years, The Art of Nonconformity, which initially began out of a quest I had to visit every country in the world. When I was a bit younger, I lived in West Africa for 4 years as a volunteer, did a lot of traveling then. Loved traveling, loved goal setting. So I set this, you know, project to go to every country in the world. Started writing about it, and fortunately, I realized that the project was much deeper than just, you know, my own little journey. So I did complete that quest a couple years ago by my 35th birthday. But then, you know, I started writing about all these amazing people that I meet all over the world. So published a few books, have a new book out called Born for This. And I feel very fortunate to connect with great, amazing people all over the world.
All right. So I want to do something that we didn't get to do the first time that we talked to you. And I want to talk about the earlier part of your life prior to everything that we kind of know you for and everything that you did on the internet, like growing up, childhood, you know, parents, significant experiences. Because, you know, the things that you've chosen to do with your life, like, I don't imagine that, you know, anybody wakes up one day and says, you know, what I have as a goal is to visit every country in the world.
Right.
So I'm just curious, you know, what are the kinds of things that happen in your life that would lead you to down this trajectory and make these kinds of decisions?
Yeah, well, that's a great way to start, because I think people always think that there are these big strategic visions, you know, that, you know, like when I was 10 years old, I was like, I want to grow up and be an explorer and go everywhere. And so then I prepared, you know, for the next 15 years and my college and first jobs and all. And none of that was the case, of course. You know, I knew I had a love for travel. I had a mom who was married to a military guy, my stepdad. And so he took us to a bunch of different places. Just because of his assignments. So I lived in the Philippines for a while, kind of got comfortable with some cross-cultural stuff. So I had this early kind of travel thing. But, I mean, lots of people travel, and most people don't necessarily, you know, get this idea to go everywhere. So I think, like, what I see if I look back is, like, it's a series of a bunch of random stuff, which, you know, eventually kind of work together to create this focus that I have now. But even in the focus, like, I think you mentioned it when you asked me for the brief introduction, you said, like, you have a lot of different projects. And I have a lot of different projects because I'm not good at doing just one thing. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of strength in someone who's like, I'm just going to do this one thing and do it well. And I think you can go far with that. But that never really worked for me. So I kind of evolved, you know, along the way. You know, different things happened that led to something else. And then I was interested in something and I pursued it. And maybe that worked out or maybe it didn't. But eventually it kind of forges into something greater, but it wasn't a grand vision at all.
So, you know, when we look back at our own lives and we look at all these random things that we've done, I mean, are there ways that you can connect the dots looking back, you know, at your own life experiences and tie them together in such a way that it leads to something that is meaningful to you?
Yes, I certainly can. And I think most people can. I think most people who are on a journey, whether it's like trying to find the work that they were meant to do, which is kind of my current focus in helping people, or just something else, I can absolutely connect the dots, even though it seemed random at the time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't good at working for other people. I wasn't a good employee. I was really good at working on something I was motivated for, like I like to work, but it was really hard for me to accept, you know, someone else's vision or work towards something that maybe I wasn't excited about. And so that's why I started working for myself. And in the beginning, it wasn't like I want to be this great entrepreneur. You know, I don't think I even thought of the word entrepreneurship at the time. You know, it wasn't like I want to change the world and, you know, inspire people to think differently or something. It was more like, how can I pay the bills, you know, without reporting to, you know, someone else's work site. And then like time goes by and I start thinking, okay, what can I build with this? And then later I get maybe a deeper desire and say, okay, well, it's great that I can make a living for myself or whatever, but that's not really, you know, that's not really like the next level mm-hmm. of things. So it's kind of like the travel goal. It was great that I was traveling for a while, but what's the next level of that? So it's a series of stages and interlinked, you know, pieces along with many dead ends, but, you know, eventually it kind of builds to something.
Well, let's talk about the dead ends and moments that didn't really work out and what you've learned from those and how you've applied those going forward.
Well, you know, I had lots of little businesses that never worked out. I mean, I had this great idea for a golf membership site that cost $1. And I remember I was like building this website and I was thinking, oh, this is the greatest idea because there's so many golfers out there and, you know, I just need like 1% of them to pay $1 or something. And somebody said to me, like, you know, it's going to be kind of hard to have a business model, you know, where your most expensive product is $1. And of course I was like, no, it's going to be great. You know? And of course it wasn't, it was a total flop and did a lot of things kind of like that were super random. And I think what saved me was I didn't invest a lot in them. I kind of would spend a little bit of time on these things, a little bit of money, you know, if any money at all. And then if it didn't work, I would just kind of move on to something else. But if I found something that worked a little bit, I would kind of go further in that. And I saw that not just with business ideas, but, you know, with hobbies. I had a million random hobbies and wanted to do a lot. I was a musician for a while and I liked playing bass. I was pretty good at playing bass. I was okay at playing keyboard or piano, but I wanted to learn to play like every instrument. So, you know, there's like a drum set in my house. There's like a bunch of guitars and a violin and a saxophone and all this stuff. And obviously I'm not really good at any of these instruments, but I'm just kind of pursuing different stuff and kind of going down different paths. And after I got, you know, tired of that or realized that wasn't going to be, you know, what I did with my life, I would move on to something else.
Hmm. Why do you think so many people hit a dead end and then don't do anything else?
Yeah, great question. Maybe they're afraid to quit. Maybe they're like, I've already invested in this, like I've got sunk costs, or maybe the costs aren't financial, but like I've spent some time doing this. And, you know, I think most people fail to kind of back out of those dead ends and pursue something different, not when they're terrible at it, but when they're just okay at it. Uh-huh. You know, and I think that's really dangerous. And I actually have ran into that many times in my life. Like, because I am kind of motivated, I can work hard. Like, I can be fairly good, you know, at a number of things. And probably a lot of the listeners, you know, are the same way because the listeners are motivated, you know, for their creativity, motivated to inspire, motivated to improve themselves, all that kind of stuff. So if you're good at a lot of different things, that's when it's kind of hard to back away from the dead ends because it's working out okay. It's all right. It's not amazing. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a real skill in being able to say, it's not amazing, therefore I'm going to back away from this dead end and try something else.
How do you balance that ability to do that with the longevity that's required to achieve mastery at a particular craft?
I don't think everybody has to worry about mastery so much, at least for a while. You know, the mastery comes, you know, when you find something that you truly do love and not, you don't just love it, but you're actually pretty good at it. Whether it's this natural gift or whether it's something that is developed. I mean, mastery is kind of like next level of something. And, you know, it comes when you're already on that path. I don't necessarily think, you know, you could be on this path for a year or 2 years or whatever the time period is. I don't know if the time period really matters. Mm-hmm. and, you know, then feel like, oh, you've got to keep going to achieve mastery or something. You know, I think mastery is the goal. If you have something clearly, you know, affixed in your mind and you're like, this is who I want to be. Like I am a painter, you know, I paint in this style. I want to learn some different art forms, but really, like, you know, this kind of painting is what I want. Then you pursue mastery. I guess my concern is a lot of people don't know that yet. You know, a lot of people are still trying to figure it out. And so don't beat yourself up over like failing to pursue the course of mastery if you're not sure what you're supposed to master.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. It's interesting because I think for me, you know, I started out primarily as a writer and, you know, I actually stopped, you know, running a blog because I realized that putting all my energy into interviewing people was a much more effective use of my time.
Sure, sure. That's like, great. So you could have just kept going, right?
Yeah.
It would have been okay.
Yeah.
Like you would have been all right, but you found something better, more effective. And so it didn't matter, you know, what you had done before. And in fact, probably what you had done before helped you, you know, in the interviewing process. But even if it didn't help you, like, you know, it's done. You found something better.
Yeah, you know, and it took a little bit. I think part of it is letting go of attachments that we have to these things. And, you know, I mean, it's like you said, the sunk cost thing can be really, really insidious if we're not careful.
Yeah, of course. I mean, well, sunk costs, it's in our nature to protect our sunk costs. You know, it's like you're in the grocery store and you pick the wrong line to be in with your cart of groceries. And this new line opens up and it's going to be so much faster, but you're afraid to leave because you've already waited, you know, 10 minutes. And if you just wait like a few more minutes, you might be at the front of the line, you know, but it's very hard to like give up and go and do something else. And I feel like that affects lots of people's decisions in life, whether it's like changing their college major. Oh, you know, I found what I really want to do, but I've already taken these courses. Maybe I should just, you know, see it through or whatever the situation is. And, you know, we have sunk costs or sunk costs. They're gone. You know, you can't recoup them. You have to always think about the present moment and think about what you're working toward in the future.
What are your thoughts on the role that persistence and grit play in these kinds of accomplishments that people dream of achieving throughout their lives?
I have a complicated relationship with persistence because it's just like working hard. Like I can be really, really persistent. I guess what I now see is a weakness. And I do think like being able to, you know, be persistent overall is a strength. But I think the challenge is you can work really, really hard at the wrong thing. Mm. And, you know, no matter how hard you work, you know, you're not going to make the kind of substantial or exponential progress that you need to make if you're not doing the right thing, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, my weakness is like I will tackle anything. I'll be like, oh, I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to work all day on this. I'm going to, you know, crush this out or whatever. And somebody else might be a little bit smarter and say, okay, but if you made these couple of different decisions, you know, about how you're structuring whatever it is you're trying to achieve, you know, maybe you didn't need to get up at 4 a.m. or maybe you didn't need to accomplish that goal in that way at all. So I think that's the challenge.
All right. Well, I think that makes a perfect setup to, you know, doing a deeper dive into the psychology and mindset that goes into something like a 10-year quest, like visiting every country in the world. You know, I'm curious, one, what enables the mindset for something that significant? Do you think everybody has that capability? Do you think it's something that can be learned or something that is inherently built into certain people?
Yeah. Okay. Great questions. Lots of things there. I do think everyone has that capability. I don't know whether it's, you know, innate or learned. I do think everyone has a capability to identify a quest or a long-term journey or pursuit. It need not be, you know, a quest to visit every country in the world or something that involves travel or the physical world. I do think we're kind of drawn to that. I do think it's exciting. I loved just traveling in general, but once I had the specific goal of like every country in the world, it made it so much more exciting. And, you know, I got a lot of criticism early on of like, well, you're just going to countries to check them off the list. And I would say, well, I actually like going to countries. I like the part about the travel, but to be fair, I actually do like the part about checking them off the list. It's actually kind of fun to like have this list of things and I'm working toward it. And eventually, you know, if all goes well, I'm going to succeed in it. And I thought about sunk costs a lot too, you know, during that process, because, you know, it was not always enjoyable. It was not always amazing. But I guess for me, I still believed in it. I believed in the long-term value of it. And then at a certain point, I think momentum does kind of kick in. Mm-hmm. You know, if like once I had made it to 180 countries, like I wasn't going to stop no matter how I felt, you know, to get to the final 13 or whatever, because I knew I would always regret it if I didn't. So, I mean, definitely like having that fixed goal is something that I think is valuable, both for having the destination and the journey. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people used to ask me a lot, isn't it all about the journey? Isn't it all about the journey? Well, it ultimately is all about the process of whatever it is. But I really do think having an endpoint, you know, in mind also helps a lot.
Do you ever want to give up during the time? And if so, how did you navigate those periods?
I never seriously wanted to give up. I had frustrations, but no, I never seriously thought about giving up. Overall, I enjoyed the long-term aspect of it, even if not every part of the short-term aspect was, and many parts of the short-term aspect were enjoyable. So I guess I thought of it as worthwhile.
So the capacity for these kinds of accomplishments, you know, you said that everybody can learn this. I'm curious, what are the things that people can do in their lives to develop this capacity?
Well, experiment. We talked about that a little bit in the beginning. You know, try different things. Learn broadly. You know, take on different skills. You know, do things that you're a little bit uncomfortable with. You know, be clear about your motivations. You know, check in on your feelings. Check in, like, how does this make me feel? Like, what do I want at any given time? And it doesn't necessarily mean you're always going to, you know, respond exactly corresponding to what you feel like, because if you're running a marathon, you might not feel that great, you know, at mile 23. But, you know, it's something you believe in, you're going to keep going. I do think it's helpful to kind of do those gut checks and to always be working towards something, you know, to always be challenging yourself. I think it's a dangerous place to be in when you ask yourself, especially as a creative, you know, as an entrepreneur or an artist, whatever, when you ask yourself, like, how am I being challenged? And you don't have a good answer for that. I think that's kind of a warning sign that maybe you need something different. And it doesn't necessarily have to be bigger or better, but maybe you need something different.
So this is fresh in my mind because I've been going through Donald Miller's book again, and sometimes I'll turn to it, you know, just to read in the morning, which is something I do before I write. And I was thinking a lot about this, especially because I was trying to write something about this morning, about why so many like sort of successful people have had these just massive failures or significant life events that precede their success. And it seems like an inciting incident is the catalyst for the really significant accomplishments of almost every single person I've interviewed, with rare exception.
Okay.
And I'm just curious, you know, what you have to say about that, what your own experience has been with that, you know, through the lens of the people that you've come across through your own work and through your own experience.
Yeah, I mean, the inciting incident, you know, is interesting. I think it's probably fair to say that anyone who makes a major change in their life, anybody who achieves something remarkable or even attempts something remarkable, yeah, I'm sure there's some moments you can point to, but I don't know if it necessarily always has to be this huge moment. You know, maybe it's a series of things that kind of, you know, led up to an inner dissatisfaction and an inner discontent that was then kind of called upon or rallied in a sense of like, okay, you know, like I feel this stirring in my soul, you know, to go and do this thing or whatever. And maybe this thing is totally crazy. You know, I talked to a lot of people, like in particular with the last book, The Happiness of Pursuit, which was focused on quests, like talked to a lot of people who, you know, use this very similar language when they began their project. And they always said, like, I had this crazy idea that wouldn't leave me alone. And so they kind of responded to the crazy idea. And then they're like, maybe it's actually feasible, you know, maybe. And the more they thought about it, the more excited they got. And then they did it. But I don't know that everybody has something like truly dramatic necessarily that incites that change. And in some ways, it's perhaps it's more interesting if you don't have like this obvious thing to point to, you know. Like I talk to a lot of people who are trying to become self-employed. And they write in like from their cubicle or wherever and say like, oh, I'm not supposed to be reading your website. You know, I'm like, I'm on lunch break or whatever, but I'm really trying to like, you know, establish some kind of freedom business for myself. And the people who are able to do that, like especially people maybe who are married, have kids, have responsibilities, or maybe they're a bit older, like they actually have something to lose. Like they can't just risk everything and like walk away and move to Thailand, become a location independent blogger, whatever. You know, like the people who are actually able to deliberately make change and then achieve mastery or whatever, go out on their own. That's kind of more interesting in some ways than the person who, you know, was fired from their job and they're dramatic and there's some dramatic scene. And then they all of a sudden they had this imperative, they had to make a living. And so they became an entrepreneur. Like, to actually take responsibility and create change without a huge inciting incident, like, that to me is almost like inspires more motivation.
Hmm. That's interesting. I've never heard it from that perspective before, but it is interesting to look at it that way. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're willing to point out that these kinds of things, like just, you know, quitting your job and going to Thailand and becoming a location independent blogger is not realistic for everybody. Because, you know, at times I can't help but wonder if the internet has perpetuated this sense of like false hope and this mantra of all of this nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've probably been part of it too. You know, I have to face facts. You know, like I try to always qualify these things, you know, but I mean, there is a dream out there. Like, you know, people are selling the dream in different ways. So I think it's important to underline the dream with, you know, disclaimers and practical, I mean, mostly helping people how to do it, but sure, you know, there's lots of stories of people who, you know, who struggle doing that, or maybe they actually are able to do it and realize it's not that great or it's not what they really wanted, you know? So probably better to help people figure out what it is they really want and how they can get that.
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about the World Domination Summit. What I really specifically want to talk about is the psychology behind how something like that happens. Because, I mean, in so many ways, you've created this sort of microculture that happens. And, you know, it's funny. One of my friends was kind of jaw dropped when he walked in to the auditorium. He's like, oh my God, he almost felt it was cult like, which was really funny. And because he was an American, and I remember that comment very distinctly. And I remember thinking the next time I get to talk to Chris Gillibo, I want to ask him about the psychology of creating a movement like that.
Okay. Wow. Great question. So we actually are really careful about, you know, having it not described as cult-like, you know, for probably obvious reasons. I mean, it's a community. It's great, you know, great people. I would say, secondly, like, I'm the first, you know, I'm the founder of WDS. We have a great team, but all of us are the first to recognize that, you know, what makes it a great community is at least 50% composed of the community. It's like the people that come, they are bringing something that creates whatever that magic is that people feel. And so I always want to acknowledge that first. I guess second, though, I would say that I also believe in a curated experience. I also believe in an agenda, in putting forward a message. I think people should do this more in their art or their work, not just like explore a bunch of topics, but let's actually like put something forward and challenge people and, you know, tell people how they can do something. Right. And so, you know, I knew from the beginning, I didn't want to create an unconference per se, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I guess what I wanted to do is like, actually, we do want to, you know, bring people together, encourage a sense of community. But we also want to have some pretty clear values, you know, of our own that are driving it. And one of them was the no sponsor thing. We don't want corporate sponsors. It's not that I think corporations are evil by default. I just don't want to mess with that. You know, like, I want to preserve the integrity of the branding. I don't want to put other people's logos everywhere. And I want to make sure that the programming, you know, is somewhat consistent. So I guess, I don't know, I believe in like creating this experience and doing everything we can, but then like it meets, you know, the other 50% of the equation, which is all the great people who come. And then hopefully, you know, something good is created from that.
Mm. It was interesting. I remember running into somebody at the last WDS that I was at, and they're like, "Who's Chris Gillibo?"
That's great. That makes me happy.
Yeah. Well, at that point, I realized, I was like, wow, you've created something that bigger than yourself. Right. At that point.
Makes me really happy. That's definitely the goal, right? To, you know, in the beginning, it was like people from the blog and stuff that were coming, and then like now, it's great that other people are there. It's perfect.
So you mentioned four words in particular that got my attention. I want to do a deeper dive into all of these. You mentioned magic, curated, agenda, and message. And I am curious how we start to incorporate those four things into our own work. Find the magic that exists in our work, curate it accordingly, be deliberate about what we do, and find the message that we're meant to share with the world. Which, right, I realize that's a whole interview in and of itself.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. So we'll try to consolidate. I think I would flip magic and put it at the end.
Okay.
So you got curate, you got message. What was the other one?
Agenda.
Agenda. Okay. So kind of put message and agenda a little bit together. And, you know, what I would suggest to anyone who's listening, who wants to have a blog, wants to be a writer, wants to put forward some kind of creative project, definitely think about what you have to say. You know, speaking of the location independent, you know, blogger who moves to Thailand, I mean, I think this has kind of died down a little bit, which is great. But for a while, you know, I used to hear from so many people who were like, hey, like, this is the life I want, you know, more or less. I want to, like, work for myself, travel everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. So my blog or my project, whatever it is going to be, like, the discovery process of my life journey to that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, it's really not that interesting, you know? Like, it's really not that interesting of just, like, one person here finding my way. Like, you really have to extrapolate beyond that and figure out, okay, like, are you trying to help other people do that? But if you're just trying to figure it out yourself, how is that helpful? You know, there's probably something else that you can do or teach or share some deeper message. And let's figure out what that is. And let's put out the agenda, right? The agenda is like consensus is overrated. Here's what I believe in. Come and join me if you agree with this or you like these values. Like, we need you. So I think that's really important. Message and agenda and curation, I guess, is the expression of that. Curation is how do we share that? What are the strategies? What are the mediums? Like, you know, and who are the speakers? Who are the voices? How are we going to get this message or agenda out to the world? And then magic is the part that's, you can't really control it. Like, there's no magic button, unfortunately. I mean, Staples maybe has that, you know, you press the thing. But magic is like this element where if you do everything right and you do allow for enough, you know, organic change to influence the process as well, I guess you're always hoping that the magic is going to come in. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. But when it does, it makes whatever it is that you are creating so much better. And that turns that into that community thing or that blog post that goes viral or that thing that really changes people's lives. And so I think when people try to harness it or try to direct it or be like, here, I'm going to add a sprinkle of magic, you know, it doesn't work so super great. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something like you have to like set everything up as best as you can, but then you like, you know, lay your offering at the altar of the gods of whoever decides that stuff. And then, you know, they kind of siphon out who gets the magic and where it goes. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I'm not done yet. I still have, that raises more questions, but you probably expected that.
Sure. Sure.
The deeper message, do you think that everybody has that in their lives?
Deeper message
behind their work.
Yeah. I think everybody has a compelling reason for it, and that's interesting. And, you know, I think when we say deeper message, again, we have to be careful because, yeah, we can go deeper into figuring out what the root of that is, but deeper doesn't necessarily imply some philosophical truth that has never been shared before. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be like this epiphany, right? The Steve Jobs moment on the stage or whatever, however you think of it. But I think everybody does have, you know, at the root of their lives, when they really get closer to finding something, you know, that has this convergence between like they're good at this thing, they love what they're doing, and it's somehow sustainable. You know, it's they found a receptive audience for it. Then I think there probably is a deeper message for it.
Hey, it's Srini. If you're enjoying this Best Dev episode with Chris, you might like our new Unmistakable Guide to Career and Purpose to help you figure out what you were born to do. If you're like most of the world, work sometimes feels like more of an obligation and necessity than a source of meaning or purpose. But after speaking to hundreds of the most successful and happy people on the planet, I know for a fact that your career and your calling don't have to be mutually exclusive. In this free ebook, you'll learn what makes a career purposeful. You'll learn the three essential ingredients that lead to a fulfilling and lucrative career. You'll discover how to consistently venture out of your comfort zone to where big opportunities come your way. And you'll get snippets from interviews with former Unmistakable Creative guests like Simon Sinek and Laura Belgray. Just visit unmistakablecreative.com/careers to sign up and learn more. With that being the case, why do you think we see such a varying degree of success with people's expressions of that message?
Well,
because I bet, you know, and I'll, you know, I won't interrupt you after this, but I'm betting for every person who buys your books out of the hundreds, one in 100 probably does something with it.
Yeah. Yeah, probably true. And I would say also, I mean, the example I would say is like, well, you know, I'm fortunate that, you know, a couple of my books have done well, but I know lots of other authors who've written amazing books you know, very helpful, great resource, but they haven't, you know, been commercially successful, or they haven't gotten in the hands of a lot of people or whatever. So, you know, why is that? It's not that, you know, my book is so much better than theirs or whatever. Maybe theirs is better than mine. So I don't know. I guess maybe that's, you know, somewhat marketing. Maybe it's somewhat the magic. Maybe it's a combination of things. Maybe it's like, how much work are they putting out? And I don't want to necessarily get into like this thing of like, you know, he who puts out the most work wins, because I think that can be dangerous too. Mm-hmm. You know, you could just be putting out, you know, the wrong kind of stuff, like we mentioned. But I do think like the more chances that you have at something, you know, the better. So I guess generally speaking, you know, instead of like slaving over something for 10 years or whatever, I would rather kind of put the balance on, I'm going to come out with something on a much more frequent basis. And maybe not all of it's going to be a home run, but I'm going to try to, you know, hit some solid things. Mm.
So I want to ask you a question that I asked a handful of people that I've had here on the show in the last probably 5 to 6 months. And this has come up multiple times for me because I'm still not satisfied with the answer I've been given by anybody.
Okay.
So Chris Sacca, the venture capitalist, has said time and again in every interview that I've seen him do in the media that when he invests in one of his founders, the one thing that he has seen in all the ones that have become successful is that they believe that their success is inevitable. They don't speak in conditional statements.
Yeah. Okay.
And so two questions come from that. One is, did you believe your own success was inevitable? Actually, more than two questions now that I'm asking them.
Sure.
Is the inevitability of success something that can be learned? And I'll remember the other one in a second.
That's fine. Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Okay. I mean, like, I feel like I should like qualify it in some way, but I would say, yes, I believed I was going to be successful. I believed it was inevitable that, you know, if I pursued this quest, I would be able to see it through. I believed it was feasible. I didn't know what would come of it. I didn't necessarily know all of the outcomes. But yes, I guess, you know, at its core, I did believe, you know, that it was going to be successful. The thing about the founder is, and I'll come back to your second question in a second, but the thing about the founder story, I like that too. I think, you know, everybody has to have the confidence, not the delusional confidence, hopefully, but everybody has to have the confidence that they're on the right track. It is going to lead to you know, something that they hope to achieve. I mean, the two points would be like, there's probably, you know, CEOs that he has interviewed or looked at that also had that confidence, but he didn't believe in their business model. Mm-hmm. So he didn't fund them. So it's not just like, this is the only quality. And, you know, the other thing is like, from the outside, we could look at, you know, a whole panel of CEOs and just know statistically that a lot of them are not going to be successful. So it's not so much that like everybody has to have this thing, but people in that situation, you know, if they have it, I guess they're more likely to have it. So is it something that can be learned? I don't know. I don't know if I have a great answer. And if you've had other people on and haven't been able to give a satisfactory answer, I don't know if I could top it, because how do you teach that? You know, how do you teach someone like really believe in what you're doing? I think it's more of a discovery process that, you know, when you find that thing you really believe in, maybe you have an innate personality that kind of leads you to believe in your own success, but then you also believe so much in what you're doing that also adds to it.
Yeah, I mean, I asked the question not because I'm expecting a concrete answer. In fact, my favorite questions are the ones that don't necessarily have concrete answers.
Sure.
Just because they lead to such interesting discussions. Actually, this was the third question I realized.
So okay.
This was based on a conversation I had with a mentor, and he had said that we are not all created equal. And in our sort of new agey self-help driven world, we don't acknowledge nearly enough the role that talent and intelligence play in these kinds of accomplishments, you know, like the Elon Musks and Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. And, you know, the thing is, the stories we hear are stories like yours, stories like Tim Ferriss. And, you know, in a lot of ways, these are outlier stories. So I'm just curious about your thoughts on the role that talent and intelligence play in the kinds of accomplishments that, you know, we talk about and celebrate.
Sure. Well, talent and intelligence, but also privilege. You know, I would kind of put that there and say, well, you know, I had different opportunities that maybe other people didn't have. And it's not because I was smarter. Mm-hmm. It's not because I was, you know, better at something. You know, I had a difficult childhood. I was a juvenile delinquent for a while. So that was not super intelligent. But I was able to kind of like, you know, make my way out of that. And some of that could very well be due to privilege, you know, or to having like upper middle class parents, you know, who cared enough to like come and get me out of jail or whatever. So I kind of go towards that. Like, I think all of these things combined, you know, definitely have some influence on who we become, mm-hmm. right? For sure.
So you said you were a juvenile delinquent for a while.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm going to let you off the hook with just that. I want to hear the details.
I want to hear about
this story. I've heard, you know, like I've heard through the grapevine about some of this, but I wanted to get it directly from you.
That's great.
I'd love to hear about it in more detail.
The grapevine of delinquency. Well, I mean, the thing about being a juvenile delinquent is you can't be it for too long, right? Like you either like grow up and go to prison or you kind of reform one way or another. So, I mean, where to start with that? Yeah, I thought I would be a good criminal at the age of, you know, 13. And I had like a little small shoplifting ring for a while. When I say shoplifting ring, it's like me and my friend and like my friend's sister. And like we would steal things and thought I was really good at it. But then obviously like the thing with like long-term crime is, you know, you can get away with it 20 times in a row, but then you get caught the 21st time. It only takes once, you know, right? So that didn't work out super great. And then I learned to drive by stealing a car. That was at age 14. And also it didn't work out super great. Like my friend and I successfully stole the car and drove it around all night. So we thought we were awesome. But then like, you know, as the sun rose or whatever, we're like, what do we do with this car? And so we decided to park it somewhere, but ran into a brick mailbox. You know, somebody called the police. Police showed up. You know, I was arrested. I mean, there were more things. There was like a series of kind of, you know, bad choices that happened over, I don't know, 3 to 4 years or so. And finally, I guess I came to my senses and realized that's probably not the best, you know, career path or life path for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like I said, it could have gone another way. You know, it could have gone a different way. And like maybe I would never have the chance to go to college or whatever, or the chance to, you know, forge those early years of entrepreneurship or, you know, all that kind of stuff.
What are the lessons in human behavior and personal relationships from that time that have actually played a role in the way you've run your business and your life later on?
Yeah, that's funny. I don't really think about those days very often, but they were very formative, I'm sure. I guess maybe there was an element of creativity to it, a desire to kind of say, is there more than one way to do this, right? And like, if I want, you know, and at the time, like this was very like, you know, undeveloped thinking. At the time, it was like, oh, I want the new Metallica, you know, cassette at the time. Like, I don't want to pay for it, therefore I'm going to steal it. So that thinking evolved, you know, and I stopped stealing things. But maybe I continued, you know, throughout college, throughout entrepreneurship, throughout Africa, throughout travel, blogging, et cetera, just always asking, like, is there another way to do this? You know, here's the traditional way. Is there not a shortcut? Is there not a fast track? Do I need to do all these prerequisites, you know, to accomplish this one thing that, you know, supposedly is going to take so much time? So for sure, that was part of it. And maybe some confidence too, although that's ironic because I wasn't successful, you know, but I guess like those CEO founders, I believed I would be. Uh-huh. Thankfully, nobody invested in me at the time.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think the theme that I keep hearing throughout all of your answers is one of resourcefulness.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. I like that word. I like resourcefulness. And I guess I always wanted to, you know, try something new. If something failed, I wouldn't necessarily try the same thing again, just like I stopped stealing cars, you know, after the bad experience at age 14.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess I would always like try to find another approach or do something different. And I'm still focused on the goal, even if I'm willing to change the strategy, which I think is a wonderful, you know, thing that entrepreneurs or artists or anybody else can do.
Mm. So one last question before we start getting into the framework that the book offers. I know, you know, earlier this year, you lost your brother. And, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people around navigating periods of extreme grief and how they've pulled out of them. It seems like it's mm-hmm. almost just kind of part of every hero's journey. And, you know, I'd be curious about, you know, kind of what your experience was with it, how it's affected your work and how it, more importantly, has affected your sort of perspective on life.
Yeah. I'm not afraid to answer that question. I just don't know if I really know how to at this point, because I actually feel like I'm still very much in that.
Fair enough.
And, you know, it's been, let's see, at the time we're recording this, it's been 8 months or so, but it honestly still feels very fresh to me. And so it is something that has affected like everything. And I think the long-term effects are still to come. I feel like I am a kind of a slow processor. And what I've learned about grief, you know, thus far is that there are different stages. And by stages, I don't just mean like, you know, the five stages of grief or whatever. I mean, more like seasons. Mm. And so you kind of settle into different seasons, you know, at different times, maybe depending on how long it's been, maybe for some other factors. So it's not something that I really had a lot of experience with, at least not this kind, until that happened. So I'm still kind of figuring it out.
Fair enough. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and let's get into the framework of the book and this whole idea that we're born to do certain things and we can find what those things are.
Hmm. Yes. So this book, like all my other stuff, kind of comes from the community. It comes from conversations I've had with different people. And this one in particular, just the notion of finding your dream job or creating your dream job, you know, run into a lot of people who say things like, oh, I love what I do. It's the best job in the world. I would do it for free, but I don't have to. I feel like I've won the career lottery. So I'm thinking that that's really interesting. And what, you know, what do these people have in common? Like, did they always know what they wanted to do? And, or was it, you know, more of a nonlinear journey? Did they do a lot of different stuff like I did? And how did they, and then how did they come to what they're doing? How did they decide if they wanted to work for themselves or if they wanted to be part of a larger organization or company? Because for years, my message has always very much been focused on entrepreneurship, because that's what I know. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, one thing I learned is that there's a lot of people working entrepreneurially within a larger company or an organization because that's the kind of work they want to do, or because they're a better fit, you know, in that kind of environment, or for some other reason. So just trying to unpack the lessons and, you know, the experiences of those people, and then present them in a way that's not just, you know, anecdotal or journalistic, anthropological, but actually prescriptive, and saying, okay, for everybody out there who wants to improve their life or work, everybody out there who's trying to find the work they're meant to do, you know, believes there is something out there for them, whether it's just like the ultimate one path, or maybe there's more than one path, but I'm trying to find the best one. Like, how do you actually do that? So that's what the new book's about.
So let's get into how you actually do that. You know, I know you, one of the things that said on the back of the book was, you know, finding sort of this intersection of joy, money, and flow. So let's talk about those three things in more detail.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think I touched on them, you know, briefly without naming them that earlier in the conversation. And I think what I found through a lot of different research is, you know, people are different. We all want different things. We all want to pursue different kinds of work. We have different working conditions, which are really important to pay attention to. A lot of people always think about their career just as this like one word thing. I want to be a designer. I want to be an engineer. I want to be a teacher. But there are many different ways to do all three of those careers. I mean, there's lots of different kind of forms and fashions of them. And that's where working conditions is so important to focus on. Mm-hmm. But joy, money, and flow is essentially something that I think everybody wants. And I think everyone wants to do something that they love, or at least that they enjoy. That's where joy comes in. You want to take pride in your work. You want to be, you know, eager to get to it in the morning or whenever it is you get to it. And money is that sustainable piece. Like I'm not really writing about hobbies. I'm writing about careers. And so if there's something you love to do that doesn't make money, that's fine. But that's not your work, or at least your income producing work. And then flow is essentially developed skill, or that point of which we can lose ourselves in our work, you know, and hours go by because we were really good at it. And maybe it's something that we're good at that other people are not good at. It comes naturally to us. And so the intersection of all three of those things, that convergence point, joy, money, and flow, is essentially the goal. And I think that's, so you ask how people find that. I think you begin by making decisions. Whenever you come across a career decision you have to make, whether big or small, you ask yourself about these points: joy, money, and flow. You know, does it meet all three of these things? If I'm deciding between two things, you know, which is the closer fit? And I think in different times in our life, we may have to make compromises, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Like you might work a job that you don't, you don't necessarily love for a while because it pays well, it provides for something else, that's totally fine. But if we're talking about the goal of, like, you know, if you could do anything, if you could win that career lottery, then it is something that has all three of those things, I think.
So, given my personal experience, a question that raises for me is, why in our lives do we often miss or overlook those points of intersection when they happen?
Well, I don't think anyone teaches us to be aware of them.
Yeah.
You know, and then I also think it's part of, like, the thing about, you can look back on the best moments of your life, but you don't always necessarily know, you know, during the time. So we can't do anything about the second thing, but maybe we can do something about the first thing, about just, you know, beginning to have more awareness of that, being to have more, you know, checking in with our feelings, and then combining the feelings check with a more objective research-based check, you know, where we're kind of like, okay, like, you know, am I really good at this thing? You know, does it produce the kind of income that I would like, et cetera. And putting those things together, I think, is really important.
You mentioned that nobody teaches us these things. Given that you go down to grad school, have a master's degree, I mean, what is your perspective on education from the vantage point that you have now?
Yeah, my perspective on education, I think fortunately education is changing and has changed in some ways, and at least in terms of a recognition that there is more than one path. It's kind of like working for yourself in general. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked for myself my entire adult life. I'm 37 now. You know, when I was in my early 20s, it was kind of a weird thing. I mean, there are plenty of other people, you know, doing business online at the time, even then, but I didn't really know any of them. Like, they were kind of like scattered everywhere, and like parents didn't really understand what I did for a living. But now I think people are coming up, and it's much more common, you know, to work for yourself. And I think that relates to that other thing. It's just now with education, it's much more common to pursue a different path and have that be totally okay. I don't regret any of the education I had. I think it was very helpful in maybe teaching me to write well, maybe teaching me to formulate arguments, maybe teaching me some social skills that I didn't get during the juvenile delinquent years. But it clearly didn't really prepare me, you know, for a specific career track, at least not in line with the investment that I made in it.
Mm-hmm. When the visiting every country in the world thing was done, do you feel any sense of, like, emptiness, or the sense that something was missing in your life because this thing that has driven your life for so long is suddenly over?
Absolutely. Completely.
And how did you cope with it?
Well, that does probably have, like, a five stages of grief thing. I mean, that probably is, like, linear, because you're like, well, got to accept it somehow. It was hard. And I saw that with everybody else that I studied in the book about quests. I mean, everyone talked about this, of, like, you come to this end and you've been looking forward to it for so long. But now, like, what are you going to do? Because for years, you know, you've been that person who's pursuing this goal, and that's a big part of your identity. You can have lots of other identities as well. You could be a spouse. You could be a parent. You know, you could be, you know, whatever your career is, all that stuff. But, you know, alongside those things has been, I'm so-and-so, and this is what I'm doing. So as to how you cope with it, I think eventually you reflect, you process, you try to appreciate the lessons, but then you have to move on to something else.
Yeah.
Because if you just live in that same thing, I think that just gets depressing. You know, like, nobody wants to be around the guy who's talking about what he did back in high school, mm-hmm. you know, or when he played football or something. Like, we all know people that 20 years later, 30 years later, however many years, they're still kind of reliving these glory days. And I don't think that's healthy. I think what's healthy is continuing to challenge ourselves.
Do you have any new quest that you've decided on? And then, you know, after such a sort of massive gargantuan quest, I mean, does it feel like anything else sort of pales in comparison when you think about it?
Well, that was the problem, you know, it was like, how do I top that? You know?
Yeah.
And, I guess also I didn't want to top it in the same way or start something new that was the same kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, I wasn't going to go back to every country in reverse order. I wasn't going to go to the moon or, I mean, people suggested that, you know, like, on my book tour, people are like, why don't you do that? And I was like, well, you can do that. Like, that would be great for somebody else. I think the next quest, essentially, you know, maybe it's a little bit more difficult to define, and a little bit more deeper. It's essentially more, you know, more about investing in community and more about, like, truly, you know, developing this idea of how do we live a remarkable life in a conventional world, and how can we see that scale, not scale in the sense of a traditional startup, but how can we, equip more people to do that. I don't think I've found the metric for that yet. I don't think I've found like, here's how I know that will be a success, which really is important in a quest. Uh-huh. But I think then the focus, for me now is not on so much like a physical accomplishment or achievement, but, kind of delving deeper into the whole purpose of all this stuff, which is what you do so well on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Wow. So in terms of WDS, what's next? I know you've scaled it back, made it smaller from what mm-hmm. I remember.
This year, we're doing two things. It's a twofold approach. And, sometimes twofold approaches work really well, and sometimes you should just focus on one thing. So we'll find out. But the twofold approach is the kind of the main immersive component of main stage WDS, the weekend experience, is scaling back to 1,000 people. And we want to provide an even more immersive experience for those 1,000. I've been very happy that the event has grown in recent years, but I also am empathetic to the concern that maybe it's I get lost in the crowd. I don't want anyone to feel lost in the crowd. We have lots of introverts. I'm an introvert. We have lots of highly sensitive people. We have lots of people who don't necessarily go to a lot of business conferences or other traditional conferences. I want to make sure we're really meeting their needs in that regard. So that's why we're doing the main stage thing. But then at the same time, we are growing everything that surrounds that. So there's going to be lots more stuff that happens during the week. It's kind of moving to a whole week long focus for us. So some people will participate in the whole week, and some people will participate just in that immersive weekend. And some people will just come to some supplemental things that we do during the week. So the new experience is going to be called WDS Connect. Mm-hmm. And that's for all the people who don't have main stage tickets but do want to be part of the community. So they can still, go to meetups. They can organize meetups. There's going to be some art exhibits, a bunch of other stuff, essentially, that will allow us to serve a larger population for the whole experience, but then a more select population for the weekend.
Wow.
So we'll see how it goes. I mean, this is our first year doing it, so you'll have to let me know, or any of the listeners who show up, be sure to let me know.
Well, this has been really, really awesome. So I have one last question, which is how we finish all our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
The willingness to find whatever that thing is for them. And I'm talking about the book a lot these days, so I keep using this phrase, the thing that they were born to do. And if readers or listeners don't like that phrase, no problem. Just think of this thing. There's this thing out there. There's something out there that you have to find. And maybe it's a missional thing. Maybe it's a calling. Maybe it's a life quest. Maybe it's a business. Maybe it's an artistic expression. Maybe it's something that I haven't mentioned at all. But there is this thing out there. And, to be unmistakable, you keep forging your way toward it, and you don't necessarily even know what it is in the beginning, just like I certainly didn't know where I was going with my life or whatever back when I was stealing cars or even when I was an adult, right? But you keep working toward it, and you do back out of those dead ends that we talked about, and you do find another way forward. You try again, but you don't try the same thing necessarily. You're unmistakable because you keep working toward that, and you do everything that you can to find it. Mm.
Well, Chris, this has been phenomenal, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and subject yourself to my crazy questions.
This is great. This is so fun. It's so much better than tell us how you started your blog. So thank you for the wonderful questions, and hope to hear from some of the listeners sometime.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.